Please join me in welcoming Don M., our main speaker tonight.
Good evening, my name is Don, I'm an alcoholic. Who's grateful to be alive, sober, and free on a Saturday night? Oh, there's a lot more life in here than that. Who's grateful to be alive, sober, and free on a Saturday night? This section's still a little bit weak, but that's all right. We're going to do a third time. Who's grateful to be alive, sober, and free on a Saturday night? You want to be alive, you got to be awake. And I want to thank the South County Speaker Meeting for asking me to come out and share my experience, strength, and hope. I want to... It's really great to see a lot of old faces, and one that I recently met was Deb, and thank you for coming out, and her friend Cindy, and to meet some new people. Where's Dawn Renee, our Hollywood starlet? Where is she? So I met Dawn. There she is over in the back. She curled her hair for tonight. We met her in the bathroom. There was a gal, I think her name was Cindy, and we were trying to adjust one little strand of hair, and I get her. I understand it completely. To see some old friends, and it's great to see Lee and April. It's really great that you're here tonight. I want to congratulate all the birthday celebrants. Getting a cake is not a big deal, try getting one, right? And I really want to congratulate you guys, and please keep your passion for this thing called life, and this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and keep your passion lit and your fire lit, because you are beacons of hope for someone that coming behind you. So happy birthday to everyone. I want to welcome all the newcomers, anyone that's new to AA, or I want to welcome anybody who's coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Anybody leave and said AA didn't work? Anybody? No one? No one left AA and said AA doesn't work? Well, I'll tell you, our book says it works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. You know, because if I'm out there trying to control and enjoy my drinking and I'm not enjoying it anymore, welcome home. And if your self-knowledge and willpower have failed you again and you have succumbed to the desire to drink again, welcome home. And if you're running around in those bedevilments sober, welcome home. But if you are drinking against your will and you are desperate and you are tired, welcome to a way of living that works. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. And we read in the readings, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Rarely and thoroughly. See, I came in here powerless, and that means, you know, without power. Lack of power is my dilemma. I had to find a power in which to live. And there is no human power that could relieve me of my alcoholism. But there is one who has all power, and that one is God. May you find him now. There's a sense of urgency there. Now is urgent. This is a life and death matter. My sponsor talks about we're not being dramatic when we say it's fatal. It's fatal. And, the sense of urgency is all that we ask that you do is grab someone's hand who has a working knowledge of this big book and is tapped into a power greater than themselves. And you can for a bit, you can borrow the power of your sponsor, you can borrow the power of the home group, but this book is information on how to gain access to a power. And it's up to me and my willingness to put it into application, to bring about that transformation, and then be that demonstration. My sobriety date is April 16th of 1994. I have a sponsor, and I have a home group. Now, that home group is the women's meeting at the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach on a Thursday night at 6 p.m. And we don't have a meeting name. Well, actually, we do. We just didn't think that the Orange County Central Office would print it. It's because we call ourselves the Sluts. And it's an acronym for Sober Ladies Utilizing the Steps. And we love our meeting name. And so I invite any women here, if you find yourself in Laguna Beach on a Thursday night at 6 p.m., come on by and you can be a slut too. And my friend Mary always said, I came in as a slut and I became a slut. And I'm like, me too. And my sponsor talks about me too. Me too are the kindest words in Alcoholics Anonymous. Did she feel like I felt? Did she do what I did? Did she think like I thought? Did she drink like I drank? Me too. Me too. I truly believe that every sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous is a demonstration of God's power to change a human being. But how do we change? Just how do we change? Well, we use the essentials of recovery that's found in this big book and the appendix two, spiritual experience. That's how. The essentials of recovery, H-O-W. And that's honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. But I believe that willingness is a key that it talks about in the third step of the 12 and 12. Because if I'm not willing to be honest, I'm not going to be honest. And if I'm not willing to be open-minded, I'm not going to be open-minded. And if I'm not willing to be willing, nothing is going to change for me. And nothing did change for me in my first year of sobriety. But I want to tell you how I got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I do that, I want to tell you a few things about me. When I was 12 years old, I had this epiphany on my parents' front porch. I had this deep in my gut, behind my belly button, knowing three things about my life. Later on, I would work with a sponsor, and she would tell me that that deep in my gut, behind my belly button, knowing is an intuition. And ultimately, an intuition is a connection to a God. I don't know that yet. I'm 12. But I knew these three things. I knew that I wasn't going to have any kids. I knew that my 30s were going to be great. And I knew that I was going to travel the world in a business suit. I was going to carry a briefcase. I was going to be much like Bill. I was going to be the head of a vast empire. I was going to manage with the utmost assurance. And I was going to prove to the world I was important. And I knew those three things at 12. Now, today, I believe that we are all born with this divine spark within us. But it's whether we fuel it or we smother it. And each and every time I took a drink, I dimmed the light of the spirit within me. And in the darkest of dark, there's always a pinpoint of light. And there's a power that is accessible and we can never be separated from it. But it got really, really dark out there for me. Real dark. You know, the big book talks about the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind, not in his body. So let me tell you what I was thinking about between the ages of 12 and 15 when I took my first drink. So when I was coming up in high school, there was all, you know, there was those social groups, you know, the socials, the stoners, the rah-rah girls, and the drill team and band and all that extracurricular stuff. And I never felt like I fit in. I felt apart from. Even our 12 and 12 talks about anxious apartness. And I don't, you know, I never felt like I, you know, I wasn't pretty enough to be in your social group. I wasn't musically talented enough to be in the band. I wasn't coordinated enough to be in the drill team. And I wasn't enough. And I have no idea where that measuring stick came from. And I'm not enough. I rode and showed horses on the weekend. I did really, really well. I won national titles, but there is not an equestrian group nor a 4-H club on campus that I could fit into. There just wasn't. There just wasn't. But I could tell you where I was and who I was with and what I drank. I was 15 years old. I was at the El Monte horse auction. I was with a group of older friends, and I drank Southern Comfort right out of a bag. Let me tell you what Southern Comfort did. Southern Comfort comforted. And it hit the pit of my stomach, and it was like, yes! And I loved the effect produced by alcohol. I loved the effect. And it stopped comparing my insides to your outsides. It stopped the chatter in my mind. And, you know, I always felt like I was running at a level of less than. And, man, I put alcohol into this alcoholic body, and I come up to the playing field, and I am flirtatious, funny, and I am life of the party. And I loved the effect produced by alcohol that night. When we get into the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get into that doctor's opinion, it says we are restless, irritable, and discontent unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. You guys put the words to the way I was living and feeling. I am restless, and I am irritable, and I am discontent unless I can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And then when I dive deeper into that sentence, that's how I'm living sober. I am restless and I am irritable and I am discontent unless I can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And I love the effect produced by alcohol, and I need to do this again immediately. So the very first lie I told was to the California DMV. I took my girlfriend's baptism certificate. I took it to the DMV counter, told them I was new to town and I needed an ID to cash checks. Signed her name, her birthday, let them take my picture, mail it to my address. It is half legit. And then I start lying to my parents and I'm telling them I'm going to the high school dances, football games, anything extracurricular to do with school. You guys all know I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous and I have never been to any one of those events. Not a one. Not a one. But you would often find me in Downey at the Mississippi Moonshine Club. And I am not there to party, have fun, or pick up. I am there to seek the relief that alcohol provided. Just you know, put me in a corner, give me a drink, prop me up, I am good. You see, what alcohol does for me, it allows me to exhale. For the very first time, I can exhale. Yeah, I love the effect. Just give me a drink, put me in the corner. That's what I love, that's what I seek. I seek to quiet the mind, I seek to exhale, and then I can feel and I can fit in. Just be with you amongst you. You know, our book talks about, it says that we forgot the strong warnings as a prejudice of our people, and that's in the doctor's opinion. And the strong warnings, I had strong warnings early on. I was blacking out early on. I had unexplained doordings in the family car. You know, my parents had come up, you know, they'd say, Don, there's another door ding. And, you know, I'd say, well, I think that they were, it was the shopping cart at the grocery store. And today I believe that they were the guardrails. And then I'd have 1 foot in the window and 1 foot out of the window. And Dad said, hey, are you coming or going? At 17 years old, there's no right answer to that. And you know, there was a time that I was drinking in El Monte on a Saturday night, and I came to him in my house on a Sunday morning, and I don't know what had happened, but I was reading the paper that morning and saw that there was a blurb in there, and it said that there was a fatal hit and run in El Monte. And I went out to see if there was any evidence of a crime I might have committed, and I'm looking for blood, hair, dent, I'm looking for anything that might have convicted me, and it wasn't me, and I'm like, whew, and I went on my merry way again. And in our book, it also talks about we're able, intelligent, friendly people. And in high school, I did really, really well academically. I could connect with the books. I can't connect with you. I need a drink to connect with you, but I can connect with the books. So in my senior year, I was the third valedictorian of my graduating class. So I got the intelligence part covered. And also, in my senior year, I was voted the senior class clown. You see, I would work with a sponsor later on, and she'd say, Don, being voted the senior class clown is a level of self-centeredness. See, I needed the attention on me. It didn't matter how I was getting it. I just needed the attention on me. And so also in high school, I never had a date in high school. I never went to the prom. I never had a boyfriend, and I never had any of those experiences. So I graduated high school, and at 20 years old, I met a guy in January, and I married him in August. So I hope you, if you're thinking about doing that now, I hope you have a sponsor. But at the time, I didn't have a sponsor. I'm still drinking and doing all that stuff. But now I'm married, and I've never had a relationship. And I've got my first corporate career job. 20 years old, got my first corporate career job, and I'm married. Now I'm doing the best I can, and I'm going to work Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, and I'm packing lunches. I'm doing the meal prep long before it's famous. I'm packing lunches and freezing dinners and doing all that stuff, and I'm trying to be this doting housewife. And I don't have any experience, but I have an example. As of today, May 2nd, my parents have been married 62 years. And so I was trying to mimic my parents' relationship, and I'm trying to be this doting housewife, and I'm going to the grocery store on a Saturday morning at 6 a.m., and I'm loading up all the groceries, and I load up the car with the groceries. I come home, I unload the groceries. Then I load up the car with the laundry. I go to the laundromat. I do all the laundry. I come home, and trying to unload the laundry out of the car, and he's still doing his dry goods on the couch. So please don't get me wrong. We're still doing lots of stuff on the weekend, but I'm trying to manage life and run the show. Being this corporate career woman, being this doting housewife, and I'm just doing the best I can, and I'm managing life. And at 5 months into that marriage, that man came home with hickeys on his neck and chest and told me they were bruises from work. And out popped that measuring stick. Out popped the measuring stick. And I'm not enough. I'm not pretty enough to be your wife. I'm not good enough to be your wife. I'm not talented enough to be your wife. You're seeking outside relations. And I don't know what to do. And so I stayed. And I told no one. But every time that man walked out that front door, I became an ugly piece of work. And he might have just been going to 7-Eleven. He might have been going to his brother's house. He might have been going to the auto parts store. Every time he walked out that front door, I start verbally assaulting him. Eventually, I physically assaulting him, and ultimately and eventually, I am being escorted out of my own home by the police. And it's like, don't you know what he did to me? Don't you know what he did to me, and I got victim of self-pity who isn't out of my pores? Don't you know what he did to me? And I did that for 7 more months. And on our 1-year anniversary, I didn't know what to get him for a gift, so I asked him for a divorce. And he obliged, and we split, and we went our separate ways. And I moved into my parents' house, and for 6 months, I cried myself to sleep. Poor, poor, poor me. Poor, poor, pitiful me. And one morning, I looked in the mirror, and I had those big, puffy, cry eyes. The ladies know what I'm talking about, the puffy ones. Not the booze ones yet, but the cry ones. And I looked in the mirror, and I said, I'm sick and tired of feeling this way. Pour me a drink. I'm going to kick ass all over this town. And that's exactly what I proceeded to do. I moved out. I moved into a roommate situation. Game on. I'm drinking on Wednesday to prepare for Friday's happy hour. Saturdays, I'm drinking to oblivion. On Sundays, I'm trying to taper off to get to work by Monday. Anybody ever notice that Jim in the Big Book shows up on a Tuesday? You're going to notice it now. But Jim shows up on a Tuesday, and I think he overshot the mark because I sure did, and I can't show up on a Monday. I'm showing up on a Tuesday. And so, you know, my solution to that, according to my sponsor later on, is, you know, I just started dating the bosses. It was my solution. It was my solution. I'm dating the CEOs and presidents of companies I'm working for, and they had no idea my capacity for drink. And see, I'd call in sick, and he'd send flowers. And then I'd come in late and be like, I'm dating the boss. I got a good gig going on. And then I start getting dripped with corporate credit cards and diamonds and sapphires and Movados, and I had arrived. I had arrived. And now I start going to, you know, New York and Hawaii and all these places, and I level up. I'm dating men of wealth, and I'm leveling up. And I had arrived, and I will tell you that one gentleman had asked me out on a date to go to the Bel Air Hotel, and I did not have a dress of that caliber. And I told him so. I said, I don't have anything to wear to the date night. And he said, well, we'll fly up to San Francisco, we'll get you a dress for date night, and we'll fly back, and we'll go on the date. And I said, all right. So we fly up to San Francisco and go to Embarcadero Center. I pick out 2 Donna Karan dresses. I can't make a decision, so he buys both. And then I get some Donna Karan sunglasses and for accessories, and we fly back. Date night comes around. I got my Donna Karan dress on, and I'm standing at the Bel Air Hotel, and I am a nervous wreck because I don't belong here. Because if you only knew who I was, I don't belong here. You can dress up my outsides, but my insides don't match your outsides, and I don't belong. So I order a drink. Of course I do. I order a drink, and I gun it down. Because I can't shake off this nervousness I got going on. I can't shake it off. I'm trying to calm down and feel like I fit in. But it ain't working. So I order another drink. And that one ends up all over my Donna Karan dress and all over the white linen tablecloth. And I am mortified. Absolutely mortified. But I like to back this up just a little bit, and this is where I like a little bit of audience participation. How many of us have drank before the date? How many of us have tried to control and enjoy our drinking while on the date? How many of us have said, excuse me, I need to go to the restroom? Then you swing by that back bar and you throw a few shots back, or you make it into the stall and you pull the bottle out of your purse. You take a few slugs and you make your way back to the table. You say, I'll have a salad. And then you got to leave that date and you got to go drink like you need to drink. And nothing was different that night. I left the Bel Air Hotel and I ended up at Pico Rivera Rim Ram Room. Now, that should just tell you a little bit, just enough. But I will give you the details. The finer details, they were cork and mirror walls, patent leather seats, barf in the bathroom, and urine on the floor. And that is the way that I like to drink. It is dark in there. And they talk about seeking lower companion, and I become the lower companion. And you know, our book talks about we are without sufficient force to bring into the consciousness the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. And I can't shake off this, you know, I can't drink away this guilt, shame, and remorse I got going on. You see, I'm sitting in a 5-star hotel room in Hawaii with him. And I can't drink it away. Can't drink away this guilt, shame, and remorse. Because see, I'm laying up in this bed with him, and he's on the phone with his wife, giving her some lame excuse about where he's at. And I like to stand here and tell you I did that one time with one man, and two times with two men, and three times with three men. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous with a wake of damage and broken families behind me, and I am not proud of that. I'm a female alcoholic, and I'll do anything I need to get what I want. And I would work with a sponsor later on, and she would tell me that, Don, you'd rob the wife of her husband, and you'd rob the children of their dad, and you'd rob their wallet because he was paying my way for a whole lot of things. But the toughest pill for me to swallow was the mere admission that I was doing the very same thing that my husband had done to me. And, you know, I got back from that weekend, and the guilt finally caught up with me, and I called it off. And from this point forward, my life becomes very, very colorful. And I start coming to at the top of Mount Baldy, not knowing how I got there or who I was with. And the only thing that I would do is I would come to and I would survey. Any surveyors in here? So I would come to and I would survey, and I would be looking for the bottle because I knew it would be the only thing that would dissolve the knot in my stomach called fear. And then I start knocking on hotel room doors in Pomona, and it is not a good area. And I'm risking my life in the need of relief. And along this journey, a man named Jack showed up, and Jack took me out on our first date, and I moved in on the second. Anybody else? No hands. I moved in on the second date. Well, he lived in Huntington Harbor. Why wouldn't I? So I move in. And he works nights, and I work days. And now I'm drinking round the clock. I'm drinking peppermint schnapps on the way to work because I know it smells like toothpaste. I have alcohol stashed underneath the passenger seat of my car. I have alcohol in my trunk. At work, I have alcohol in the right-hand side drawer of my desk. Lunchtime comes around, I call up the Japanese bar, give her two words, Black Russian, and she's got two lined up when I get there, and I gun those down. Then I run across the street to Circle K, I grab a Circle K cup and a vodka bottle, because that is my afternoon drink for the office. And on the way home, I have bar tabs, liquor store tabs, restaurant tabs from work to home. In my house, I have alcohol stashed in my shoe boxes, I have it in my suit pockets, I have alcohol underneath the kitchen sink way in the back, and I end up having it in my toilet tank because I need alcohol to survive. And I was taken to that the line in the book and the literature, and it says liquor ceased to be a luxury and became a necessity. And you didn't have to explain it. I knew exactly what it meant. And later on it said alcohol was my master. And it absolutely was. It was dictating my life. And during this relationship, has anybody ever come to in the middle of a field sobriety test? I told the police officer that I could not perform this function because my equilibrium was off due to an inner ear infection. I went to jail that night. Has anybody ever come to in a city you didn't know existed? Mine was La Palma. Now, La Palma is 1.82 square miles. I Googled it. Researched at the time, but anyway, I was pulled over for an obstruction of traffic because I was going 8 miles an hour trying to get somewhere. I was arrested. So during these little nudges, I got that little court card, the little nudge from the judge, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I come in here and I listen to the differences and not the similarities. I don't hear Step Sponsorship God. I don't hear Unity Recovery Service. I don't even hear Sober Living, Detox, Rehab. I hear nothing. But I hear your stories of pain. And I'd be like, yeah, man, I drink too. And then I hear your stories of joy. And I'd be like, absolutely great reason to drink. And I don't even know you're sober. I have no idea what's going on here. I think you guys are just a group of people talking about your escapades. I know now that when I come in here and I hear your stories of pain, it's divided amongst us. And when I hear your stories of joy, it's multiplied by all of us. But I got to come all the way in and sit all the way down here and become a member and not an attender. Become a member and not an attender. But that won't happen for 2 more years. One night, Jack called me up and he called me up from work. And he said, I'm not going to watch you kill yourself or anybody else. I'm leaving. And he left the house I moved into. Let me repeat that. He moved out of the house I moved into. And, you know, our book talks about, it says we blot out the consciousness of our intolerable situation the best I can or accept spiritual help. And I don't think I needed any help. And he's gone. But Huntington Harbor is really expensive on a single income. And I got rent or booze. Rent or booze? I move. I go to Seal Beach. Seal Beach is an old town, a lot of money and a lot of booze and a lot of blackouts. And I can, you know, I lived there for 2 years. I can tell you two things, Hennessy's and Main Street. That's it. But somehow I managed to hold on to a job. I don't know how. I do not know how. But on April 15th of 1994, I blacked out one more night and my roommate and her boyfriend put me to bed. And I came to the next morning. Now, I'd had the DTs before, but I'd never had them this bad, and I was shaking violently, and I could not stand fully erect. And I knew I had to get to work, so I had to get into the shower. And I half crawled, half walked to get into the shower. And when I got into the shower and the water hit my body, it felt like I'd been hit by pellets and pins. And when I went to wash my hair hurt, and I knew it would fix it, and it would be another drink. And so I went down to the liquor store and I bought another bottle of Bacardi, and the rest of the story has been fed back to me by those involved. My employers broke into my house and they broke into my room and they tapped me on the shoulder and they said, pack your bags, you're going somewhere. And I will tell you that for a moment I was instantly sober. And I don't talk about that moment of clarity. I talk about that moment of truth. Because I had that deep in my gut, behind my belly button, knowing it was all over. And I went, okay. And I had no fight. I asked no questions. I dutifully followed direction. I packed the duffel bag. I put my bottle of Bacardi in there. And they said, go through the door and get in the car. And, you know, they talk about there are no dues or fees here. Yeah, there are. I paid him out there. You know, our friend Sharon C. says, you know, I just had a few minutes to tell you some of the highlights of my drinking. I haven't told you my lowlights. And our friend Sharon C. says, you know, we slid it all across the bar for another drink. And I used up my body, and I used up my self-esteem, and I used up my dignity, and I'll remind you that I'm a female alcoholic, and I'll do anything I need to get what I want. And I believe that we all have one or two of those demoralizing moments. The most demoralizing moment for me was being escorted into a detox by my employers. But I want to remind you that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, the acronym for that is PAID. I paid a huge price. A huge price. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, paid. So I get escorted into the detox, and they're going through my, or in a, they're going through my bag, and they find my Bacardi, and I am pissed off because I have no idea what's happening. And they said, well, listen, do you need to make any calls? And I said, nope. And they said, well, do you have any parents? And I said, yeah, but they moved out like 35 years. They moved out of state 35 years ago. I don't need to call them. I'm an adult. And they said, well, do you have anybody that need, you know, because you're going to be here for a minute. Does anybody need to know where you are? And I'm like, I've got this. And I'm trying to manage my life and detox. And they said, well, listen. And finally, I was fighting them for a little bit. And finally, I conceded. And I called my parents. I said, Mom, Daddy, you sitting down? And they said, yeah. And I said, I'm in a detox for alcohol. And they said, oh my God, Don, where are you? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. And they said, we'll find out. And I said, where am I? They said, you're at New Beginnings. I said, Mom, Dad, they tell me I'm at New Beginnings. And they said, well, where are you physically? We'll fly down, we'll assess the situation and see how we can help you. And I said, well, you just stay where you are. And they're like, by God, Don, you are a daughter. We need to know where you are. And later on, I would learn what we do to our families, even out of state. You know, we have undue stress and worry, put that on them. Like my mom, she'd call me, and we'd been on that phone for about 3 minutes. And Mom would say, Don, have you been drinking? No, click. And then they can't find me for 3 days. And so, you know, we find out what we do. And they're like paranoid, like, where's our daughter? So I finally said, well, where am I? And they said, you're at New Beginnings at Clark and Candlewood and Lakewood. I said, Mom, Dad, they tell me I'm at New Beginnings at Clark and Candlewood and Lakewood. My mom, there's a pause on the other side of that phone. My mom said, at Clark and Candlewood and Lakewood? I said, that's what they said. My mom said, Don, in 1964, you were born there. It was Lakewood General Hospital at the time. And that was another moment where God was getting my attention. I thought, man. If this place is, you know, if I was biologically born here and this place is called New Beginnings, maybe I get a new beginning on life. Maybe I get a new lease on life if I just stayed. So I stayed. 2 weeks later, the insurance kicked me out. And I'll be forever grateful to Bill and Bob who talked about attraction, not promotion. And there was a woman, and her name was Eileen. And Eileen ran this aftercare program. And I wasn't required to attend it, not by my insurance, not by my employers, no one. But see, Eileen had this genuine, authentic smile. She had an inner peace that radiated out. She was happy. You didn't have to ask her. You could see it. You could feel it because she vibrated. And I wanted what she had. So I sat next to her week after week after week thinking I'll get it dropped by transference. And I had no idea there was work involved. Ladies and gentlemen, I did that for 1 year. I went to meetings, and I went to that aftercare program and sat next to Eileen. And I did nothing in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And on my 1 year sober anniversary, I am restless, and I am irritable, and I am discontent, unless I can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few steps. I was on the phone that night with another alcoholic, and I said, if this is what sobriety's all about, I don't want any part of it. I'm a miserable bitch. This sucks. And they said, why don't you get a sponsor? Why don't you work the steps? Why don't you go to some women's meetings? Why don't you get involved in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and your life will change. And on the phone on that night, my willingness was born. I was all in. Admit one. Ladies and gentlemen, all I did was I laid the bottle down. I was physically sober. I was sober. I was sober. Sober. But I hadn't quite recovered my mind, and I was still suffering from a spiritual malady. So I took those directions. I took the suggestions, and I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps, and she's doing her job, and I'm doing mine. But I was able to grab onto those the cassette tapes. They weren't 8-tracks. They were cassettes. Some of y'all know what 8-tracks are, but I got a hold of those cassette tapes because I had a long trek from work to home, and I started listening to the speaker tapes. And two speakers broke down the steps in a manner in which I heard, which made the steps come alive, which made the steps more palatable, like syrup on your pancakes, like I could drink it all up. And those two speakers broke down the steps in this manner. One speaker said, one is me, two is God, three is me and God, four and five is me, six and seven is God, eight and nine is you, 10 is me, 11 is God, and 12 is you, and there is no one else to play with. And the other speaker said, one is I am the problem. Two is come to believe there's a solution. Three is a decision to seek that solution. Four through nine take care of the past. 10 takes care of our daily life. 11 takes care of our spiritual life. And 12 takes care of our AA way of life. Now, AA is the way I live. It is not something I do or attend. It's the way I live. Like, I can come up here and talk a good game. How am I living out there? How am I living? Am I living a spiritually disciplined life? Am I practicing kindness, courtesy, justice, and love? How am I treating the elderly? How am I treating that 7-Eleven clerk? I'm a dog owner. Am I using the blue bag? You know, our book talks about we're in the world to play the role God assigns us. And I've been given roles all day long. I'm a daughter, a sister, a wife, a friend, an aunt, a sponsor, a sponsee, an employee, a volunteer, I'm a citizen. Like, am I giving 110%? How am I living? How am I living? So I live this thing. So, ladies and gentlemen, what I had done is I had laid that bottle down, and I was fellowshipping for 1 year. Please don't get me wrong. The fellowship will support us, but the steps change us. The fellowship will cure the loneliness of alcoholism, but it will not produce the entire psychic change. The steps do that. The steps do that. So I got active in and got into our book and deep into our literature, and I'm passionate about it because our literature can save lives. And what I did was, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started coming into the meetings in our book, and I will always be forever to the chapter called We Agnostics, because I came into AA and I started to see, I told you a little bit of how I was living, and I saw this God thing, and I had come out of a religion at 13 years old and that I did not believe in or understand. And my parents said, you can opt in or opt out, and I opted out. And so I had this idea of a great big God, but I told you how I was living out there, and I just didn't feel worthy of God's love. And I come in here, and I'm watching you, and you guys are my hope in human form. You see, in We Agnostics, it says, lay aside a prejudice, express even in willingness. Cast aside an old idea, welcome in something new. And so I'm watching you guys. And I'm watching you, and I'm starting to watch your eyes start to twinkle, and I'm starting to watch your skin glow, and I'm starting to watch your character change. And I can't see, feel, or touch your God. But that God that's working in you, could it possibly work for me? And in the book, it says I can have a limited conception. I could start there. And so I picked the wind. Because I can't see, feel, or touch the wind, but I could see the effects of the wind rippling through the leaves of a tree. And I could feel the effects on the wind of my face. And the wind is so powerful, it can change a landscape. And the very same thing that I can't see, feel, or touch is changing your landscape, I'll pick that wind until I can establish my own relationship with the God of my understanding. And I could tell you the very paragraph on the very page that changed my life and changed my mind in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's on page 55. Because it says deep down, and every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. And later on it says, in the last analysis, the booze, the money, the men, all that human power couldn't relieve me of my alcoholism. And I connected with the deep down. The deep down. Because I'd had it before, and I'd had that experience, and I knew I could get it again if I just continued to seek. And you know, step three talks about, it's in that prayer, it says, relieve me of the bondage of self. It never says, relieve me of the bondage of alcohol. It reminds me that I am the problem. And I want to tell you what that looks like when I'm 16 years sober. So at 2 months sober, I get a job, the best job, get well job. The best job I can get is a file clerk for a temp service. That's what I could do at 2 months sober. File clerk for a temp service. And so, I had some good work ethics and I get to this job and I start, I get to work on time. I put my, I give them an honest day's work for an honest day pay. And I do my job and just keep my head down. You know, that's what AA taught us. You know, we show up, we do our job and go home. And that's what I did. I was doing my filing, showed up on time, did my filing, head down, just keep doing my job. And that company that the temp service had put me in, they hired me up and out of that temp service and into this this corporation. And I started working overtime, and I started asking questions of different departments, and I put myself through school on my own dime, and I started to climb that corporate ladder like I said and knew I would on my parents' front porch. 16 years sober, I become the senior manager of a global corporation, and I got power, prestige, and a pocketbook to back it. And then I start treating my employees with rudeness and curtness, and I'm condescending, and I'm demanding, and I'm insulting. And the employees didn't like that too much. They took it as long as they could. But eventually, they took me to HR. And I got written up. And I have never been written up in my entire working career. Never. And that fear of losing my job, and the book talks about that fear, the evil corroding thread, the fabric of our existence is shot through with it. You bet. The fear of losing that job and that paycheck rolled out into the women I sponsor, rolled out into the families, rolled out into friendships, and I'm taking everybody hostage, and it's like, don't you know what they did? And this is what they said, and it was all about them. And eventually that fear rolled out back into work, and I start treating my employees with rudeness and curtness, and I'm condescending, and I'm demanding, and I'm insulting. And through a series of events, I don't have time to tell you about, I was fired in sobriety. Boom, on the floor in a fetal position with bubbles coming out of my mouth. I didn't drink. But I'll tell you what, I called in my sponsor and I said, I can't breathe. I feel cut off at the knees. I feel gut punched. And my sponsor said, girl, you've been leveled to grow. And there's a bottom below the bottom, you know. I had no idea what had happened. I know now. I was plugging into the wrong power. I was plugging into human power again. Subtly over time, it had shifted, and I was plugging into power. That was power. You know, a lot of people would say, you know, did you pray and meditate? Well, I get all prayed up and I'd walk out my door and I'd walk into the threshold of that job. And the first email, first phone call, it was power. I was power. And I had, I had spiritual warfare going on inside that job. And so my sponsor took me to a line in that big book, and it says, the wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea of voicing it without reservation. And I was asked to write my own third step prayer. And I did that in the middle of an Albertsons parking lot, and I was cracked wide open for a brand new experience. Brand new experience. I'm not going to talk about 4 through 9. I'm going to talk about 10, 11, and 12. Our friend Bill C. talks about steps 1 through 9 are 10% of the program. Steps 10, 11, and 12 are 90% of the program. And I believe that to be true because we have some action words, continue, improve, and practice. So continue, it's a step 10. Now, for me, step 10 is the least used and often overlooked step. That's my observation. It's been my experience. See, what happened was people would tell me, did you pray and meditate about that thing at the job? And I'd say, well, but I wasn't doing step 10 to flesh out what to take to prayer and meditation. I was just praying to meditate. But what 10 does is it keeps that channel open for grace to flow. And it's, it says, this is how we react so long as we're in fit spiritual condition. 5 lines later, it says we have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I'm like, what's the condition? And it means unblocked. So I got to keep this channel open. It says, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear when these crop up. Not if, but when. And they're going to, and they do. But my best gauge for my step 10 is my external behavior is the result of my internal condition. My external behavior is the result of my internal condition. And I will tell you, and I only have a few minutes left, but this is how we react so long as we're in fit spiritual condition. September of 2024, I was blindsided and I was dumbfounded and I was slapped in the face with a life experience. And I will stand here and tell you that I did not react well. And between September of 2024 and September of 2025, it was probably worse than when I got fired. But I had enough in my spiritual bank account that I could withdraw and lean into a power greater than myself. I will tell you, I was leveled for another opportunity for spiritual growth. I mean, hopefully I'm continuing to grow, that we grow every day. But I really needed that bank account to withdraw from. It was really tough. And I could say in the last 7 months, the dust has settled. It took a long time. But I was truly leveled. And my sponsor always said, another effing opportunity for spiritual growth. But I'm grateful for sponsorship. I'm grateful for the women I sponsor. I'm grateful for all the people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous who stand shoulder to shoulder. And we walk beside each other to get through the hard times. Because it says in our book, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And they are certain, and they do come. And step 11 says improve. And improve means make better, enhance that which was already there. What I came here looking for, I came looking with. And all I'm asked to do is shine it up. See, my sponsor said, if you seek God in the morning, you don't have to seek him the rest of the day. But if you don't seek God in the morning, it's your first act of self-will. And meditation is the medication for my malady. I drank for the effect, and now I'm going to meditate for the effect. Drinking is, the effect was very instantaneous, short-lived. Meditation may take a little bit longer, but the meditation, the peaceful and serenity, it lasts a little bit longer. And I will tell you that it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, not as the result of my attendance. I did that too. See, I'm here because somebody delivered me. And my job really is to be in the room and look for the new face, look for the one that's terrified, look for the one that's angry to be here. Because really, what we're here to, what my job really is to do is grab someone's hand and pull them out of the dark and put them on a path and be a light to guide the feet that are afraid. And then put their hand in the hand of God and leave it there and let them do that for someone else. Because we're all here just to walk each other home. You know, our book talks about we have recovered and been given the power to help others. To help others. And I will tell you that I will end with this. At 5 years sober, I realized I never had any kids. I was 29 and a half years old when I got sober. And I've been able to travel the world. It's never been through business. It's always been through different opportunities presented. I've been to China, South Africa, France, Ireland, Honduras, Fiji, St. Croix, all these places. And there's always been a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at our destination. But I truly will end with this, is that we had an opportunity to go on the Great Wall of China, and we were with a tour group. The bus driver said, hey, listen, you get off the bus, you can go to the left, you can see it's a very easy climb, very congested, you can't get very far on the Great Wall, or you can pick this other side, and it's very steep, nobody's on it, it's an optical illusion. Listen, you take your pick, we'll see you at 3. So we pick the difficult climb, of course we do, and we start climbing this Great Wall of China, and there's no quality control back there, and the steps are really wide and really narrow and high, and it was all over the map, but it was an optical illusion. I start climbing this, climbing the Great Wall of China, and I lost my breath, and I said, okay, hold on, let me catch my breath, and then the next thing I know, I've lost my stamina. I'm losing my strength. I said, hey, Steve, can you push me? Can you pull me? And he goes, I'll do what I can. So he pushes me up a little bit further, and then eventually, I lose my strength, I lose my stamina, I lose my breath. I'm like, I got to stop, hold on. So let me catch my breath, let me get strength back, and we start climbing a little bit further. It truly was an optical illusion. And we get to this plateau. And on this plateau, the vision that I received is very much similar to what you see in the postcards. I saw the Great Wall of China wrapped for miles with nobody on it. And I dropped to my knees on the Great Wall of China, and I said, dear God, never in my whole life would I have ever imagined that I would ever be on the Great Wall of China. Thank you for this opportunity. And this is what came back to me. This is your life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes the steps take our breath away. And sometimes we have to ask for help. Can you help me with this 4-step? Can you help me with some 9-step amends suggestions? Can you give me some prayer and meditation techniques that you use or suggest? Sometimes we just got to stop and ask for help. And sometimes we just got to stop and regroup and get the courage and the strength to move on. And on that wall, I realized I achieved the level of Eileen's peace, that lady way back in the aftercare program. Because I can tell you that every time that I apply the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, they have always provided me a quiet mind and a skip in my step, a joy in my heart, and peace in my soul. And I hope and pray they do for you too. And then you go grab someone's hand and pull them out of the dark and put them on a path, and may we awaken and live. Thanks for letting me be here tonight.